Welcome to our paranormal afterlife. This is our paranormal afterlife, and I'm your host, Simon Bowne. And if you want to hear the extended version of this episode, please join the Patreon campaign. This week, I've put together a number of clips from the Patreon extended episodes. These clips haven't been heard before on the free feed, and they should give you an idea of what you're missing out on if you're not a patron. First of all, we hear from Anthony Peak. Anthony talks about a remarkable example of terminal lucidity.
I wanted lastly to ask you about this thing of terminal lucidity, where there's people who may have really advanced Alzheimer's and their brain is not capable of consciousness, but they seem to come back close to death and they're their normal selves.
Fascinating. Pekindarian experiences, as they are technically known, taken from the Keats poem, A View from a Hill in Darien, I think it was Keats. And it's the idea that when you are approaching death, you can see further. You can see a new world. But on top of that, people seem to become lucid. And I'm going to tell you a tale now that was witnessed by me and my wife regarding my own mother. She had been ill with terminal Alzheimer's for about 2 years. And for the last 6 months before this incident took place, she was non-communicative. She was effectively like a baby. You know, she was in her mid-90s, no communication. She was just in a coma state, really. She never recognized us or anything. So that's the situation I thought my mother was in. I get a phone call one night from the home she was in. And the matron in the home was saying, "Tony, you need to talk to your mother." And I said, "Why do I need to talk to my mother?" She says, "Well, she's here." And I could hear her shouting in the background. And I could hear her saying, "You're not going to get away with this. I'm going to sue you. When my husband finds out about this, you know, this is terrible." So they hand the phone to my mother. Remember, this is my mother who was comatose, who hadn't even properly moved for 6 months. Completely active brain. And she goes, "Oh, Tony, these people have kidnapped me." She said, "I'm going to sue them. When your father finds out, we're going to sue them." And she said, "And I don't know what's happening." And she said, "It's really, really weird." She said, "I was sitting watching television with your father, and we were watching Morecambe and Wise. And suddenly I go for 40 winks and I'm here. And I'm trapped, and these people have got me captured." And I said, Mum, Morecambe and Wise are dead. My dad's dead. You're 94 years of age." She said, No, I'm not. I'm in my 40s. And I said, "Mum, look at your hands." And she said, "Why do I need to look at my hands?" And I said, "Because you'll see you've got an old person's hands." And she went, Oh my God, I've got old. And then she goes, "You're not my son. You're an old man. You sound like an old man. My son is 21 years of age. He's away at university. Who the hell are you? You're part of this." And she slammed the phone down. I then phoned back and they calmed her down. Now imagine a scenario. And again, in my hypothesis, I tell you exactly how this happens, by the way. In the book, I explain fully what is going on here. It's again related to what we were talking on earlier on about panoramic life reviews, past life reviews. She was accessing a section of her memory from 1973, okay? But there could be another corollary. Imagine the terrifying scenario that she was actually sitting watching television with my father in 1973, did turn 40 winks and found herself an elderly woman in a home. Now that is terrifying. And is that what happens with Alzheimer's? Because I know with schizophrenia, in my research into schizophrenia, talking to schizophrenics, talking to the people who work with schizophrenics, the schizophrenics, their time flow is different. They literally can go from one part of their life to another. There's no concurrent time for them. Time is an ever-present, and they flip from place to place, which is what causes them the issues and difficulties in dealing with the reality around them. Now, my mother then had that experience, and I strongly suggest you check out and get on your show, if you can get the opportunity, is an associate of mine called Maggie Latourelle. And through my ministrations, I managed to get her a book deal And her book is called The Gift of Alzheimer's. And in fact, they did a radio play based upon the book with Frances de la Tour and the actress that was in Truly Madly Deeply. I can't remember her name now. And both of them took off Maggie and her mother on in a stage play based upon this experience. But Maggie's mum also started descending into Alzheimer's and had gone to a home. And Maggie was starting to watch some of the things that were happening with her mother. And she was so intrigued, she kept a diary. And this book is the diary of her mother's experiences. And I'll give you one experience of what happened to her. This really shows how terminal lucidity takes place. Maggie lived in London at the time, and she was planning to drive up to in the west coast of Scotland to visit her mother. And it's the Friday morning, and she's having coffee with a friend. And a friend said, oh, I didn't realise that's where you came from. And Maggie said, oh, yeah, I'll show you. And they got Google Earth up. And on Google Earth, they zoomed in to Maggie's mother's house. And in the drive was Maggie's old red Mini. And Maggie said, that's weird. I haven't had that Mini for 3 or 4 years. So obviously the photograph is quite old. And they had a discussion about Maggie's Mini. And she then gets in the car and she drives up to see her mother. And she drives the next day, goes into the home. As she gets into her mother's room, her mother's looking out of the window. And without turning round to look at her, she said, talking about Maggie's Mini. We're talking about Maggie's Mini. All very interesting, Maggie's Mini. And Maggie said, my heart almost stopped. I couldn't believe what she was saying. And she said, how did my mother know that? So she then started this document about her mother. Her mother turned around and said, the entities were playing around with her brain. They were reformulating her brain to prepare her to die. She started seeing her daughter, who had died a few years previously. Maggie then was seeing her father because they were doing the legal aspects of the sale of the house, which they weren't telling her mother. Her and her father went round one day, and the first thing the mother said was, you're not doing all this legal stuff without me. Terminal lucidity. Peak in Darien experiences. It clearly means, and I argue the reason being, going back to my cheating and the ferryman concept, what is happening is the brain is playing around with itself because it's preparing to die. And in doing so, it is starting to access the knowledge banks of the daemon and the uberdaemon. And they're leaking through across the corpus callosum from the non-dominant hemisphere of the brain. They're linking through to eidolonic consciousness. And that's why people start feeling they're going back in time. Now, there is a thing called neonatalism, which I witnessed in my mother. Have you ever noticed when people get older and older, it's as if they're going back to the womb? They get smaller and smaller, they come more crooked. And by the end of my mother's life, she was actually in a position like a fetus. Now, not only this, but I tested my mother because I know there's something called the Babinski reflex, which is basically when you tickle the bottom of somebody's foot, and I'm not sure whether they twist inwards or outwards, but newlyborns go in one direction and normal people go in another. She did the newly born spasm. She was already in the womb. Her body was already in the womb. She was getting prepared to be reborn. And again, in my writing, I am literally the only writer in the world making these links. There is nobody else making these links. Nobody anywhere. But it is provable. And I'll guarantee if you take anybody who is in that kind of state, you will get the Babinski reflex. The question is why? You also know that people, when they get older, they start getting memories of their past really vividly. Also, déjà vu starts again. Déjà vu normally stops or dries out when you're about 22, 23. And then for most of your middle life, it doesn't occur. And then it starts again. Starts again because the memories are being spontaneously drawn up from somewhere. And that's because you're preparing to die, because you're preparing to go back to live your life again. Or live another life as you again. And that's the important point.
Next, we have DJ Kadagian. He talks about the idea that near-death experiences are tailored specifically for the individual. There is details in people's near-death experiences that seem to be kind of tailored specifically for them and their personality. And I interviewed a lady called Nancy Rines, and she talked about her near-death experience. She found herself in this incredible landscape that she said it was like Scotland, and there were forests and mountains in the distance. And there was somebody, she said, who was from her spirit team, was with her. And she looked behind her and the whole landscape was just dissolving away into a mist. And this spirit said to her, everything here, this was constructed just for you right now for this near-death experience. And so I wonder if every near-death experience is like that. It's a kind of a theatre production where they give you exactly what you need.
I would say that makes a lot of sense. And it's probably similar to here. They would say that in the ayahuasca experience, you don't always get what you want, but you get what you need. And the things that happen to us on this plane, you know, you may not want a lot of the things that are happening, but, you know, there's a reason, you know, why these things are happening. But looking at that, being in that environment is very, very common. I find it really interesting when they go into these cities. A lot of people experience cities and crowds, and sometimes they talk about millions of people. It just goes on as far as you can see. And they describe them similarly. And that, to me, is one of the most fascinating things. But other people don't experience. That's not that common, but it's common enough where I find it interesting. But instead of going there, oftentimes people will find themselves in a more natural environment, and there's one house, nothing else around it. So getting what they need. Now they enter, they go to the house and they always enter it. The house is nothing to speak of. They don't describe, well, it was gilded and there was gold. That's what you hear always about, you know, very fantastic buildings when they go experience a city and the libraries and these types of things. But the homes are just, they almost feel lonely. And they're, you know, in a flat area with nothing around there. But they know they're supposed to go in. And that doesn't happen as much in the cities. And they generally experience something or meet someone that had passed away or had a special message from them. Very, very different experiences. And so tailored to each person, I think, absolutely, in some ways. And again, it's... I have to think that the way people experience this kind of realm, if there's so much on the other side that's so unexplainable, we have to somehow make it real or interpret it through our subconscious, you know, attach some type of meaning to it. And so that's why in the American Indian would go down the river, whereas we go through the tunnel. That's the most, by far the most, the tunnel experience. You don't hear Westerners say that, you know, that I went down the river to get there. It's always the tunnel, when you would not hear that expressed, you know, from for example, Gregory is, you know, the way he lays out a lot of the literature that and stories that came back from that. So it's how we can experience it. And we all have very different personalities. The overarching scene, the major experiences that we know of that occur through a near-death experience and like through the crossover experience, those are all thematically similar. But, you know, there are details they're different shades. They're just like slightly different shades, but telling the same story. And what you learn over there, again, could be different depending on where you found yourself. But as you said, they're there, and they are, they're there for, it just seems like, yes, they're there for a reason. They're there to learn something, or just to learn that there's something more and give them more hope, or what have you. You often get the sense that they're, when they come back, and the sense that what they're told, they're coming back for a purpose. And what I find interesting is, they don't tell them what the purpose is. And they don't say, you have a purpose, you're supposed to teach, you know, children how to speak English, slang, whatever it might be. You don't hear that. You hear, you have a purpose. And oftentimes they come back and they're very frustrated because they don't know what it is. And they may not know what it is for years. And so there's a lot of them struggle, and others say, well, it must be to tell people what this is, which makes sense to me. So it'll go around and tell their stories. So it's different, but I think it's why you see so many of these people writing books and because it is helping people. It's changing people. I don't know that people change in such a healthy way. It's not therapy, which is, you know, extremely valuable. It's not trying to blowing the doors of perception off with psychedelics, which is now being used much, much more in the United States and in all the world in different types of therapy. My wife is a psychotherapist, and these things are being legalized for therapy, which I think is smart. But psilocybin mushrooms, MDMA, even LSD, which initially they were using to test ways of change, you know, helping people, ibogaine, people that do that are able to come off drugs at a rate that's radically better than, you know, therapy or going to rehab centers or methadone clinics or what have you. I find that the near-death experience has such a holistic kind of healing and addresses so much of what keeps us from experiencing and enjoying, you know, being here right now, being present. It's somehow breaks that down. It just, when you watch enough of them, listen to them and do enough research where you're like, you know what, there's something's going on here. So you're like, this is it just stuff starts to kind of fall off of you. And I think you notice that they've done studies where people that have had that, they have less, they have much lower blood pressure. They have less from then on. They, you know, lower incidence of, you know, heart issues. They just physically it changes them too. So it's really, all these things are signs and the statistics are there. How do you explain it? I can't think of anything else, you know, and I talk to friends about it sometimes and I just don't anymore because, you know, I'm a little bit out there to begin with, but this is just, you know, the kicker. Even when I talk about, hey, Department of Defense, you know, they just hear the pictures, the UFOs. I mean, I'm not making it up. There it is. You know, I think the near-death experience is a bridge too far. And unlike the UFO, we'll never have pictures of them flying around from the Department of Defense. But I would say statistically speaking, there's much more evidence in terms of the near-death experience. There really was no major evidence, statistically speaking, of the UFO. But certainly in the universe, statistically speaking, it'd be impossible with the billions and billions and billions of planets and universes that didn't exist. Even still, people didn't believe it. And even still, they don't talk about it. I don't understand it. I don't, you know, I cannot understand how that story could have been put out by, you know, the New York Times and on 60 Minutes. I mean, the most reputable, whatever you think of them, which is not much anymore. But how isn't this being talked about? I think that they'd have to land on the White House lawn, you know, and walk into, you know, shake hands with the president. I don't know what it'll take. So certainly the near-death experience is a hard thing for people to wrap their heads around. But the people that have had them, you know, you'll never in a million years convince them that it wasn't real.
Now we have Kathy Gabrielson, who is talking about a shared death experience.
Earlier you said that you had a shared death experience where you saw a tunnel. What happened there?
Oh, the shared death. Like I said, all these experiences with a near death, whether it was a distressing one or a good one, or, you know, regardless of the experience, having the experience has really opened up the spirit world for me and no more judgment. And this is truth. This is what happens when we die, and we don't die, but this is when we die, our physical body is dead and we move on in spirit. But so I had a very dear friend of mine that had advanced cancer, and she was actually really afraid to die. And this is the first time I'm saying this publicly out loud, Simon. So and you'll be my first audience to hear it. But it was my very good friend of mine, and she was sick, and she was she was really scared to die. And a few months before she passed away, she had said to me and another friend of mine that she was really afraid to go, that she was afraid that she wasn't going to know anybody on the other side. And she wasn't sure about where her soul would go or where it would be, or would she be alone? And as she was in the hospital, and she was in hospice in the hospital, and my friend and I really were round the clock with her at her bedside. She just didn't want to die alone. And she had a husband and a daughter, but she really chose and expressed that she didn't want them to be with her, because she didn't want them to see her suffering and taking her last breath. And how beautiful was it? They honored that that wish of hers. And she was really terrified. And, you know, her soul, like my boyfriend's soul, when I was at his bedside, I could sense it was leaving. And I understood with my dear friend at the time that was just happening, because I remember that same sensation about when I was with my boyfriend. And she was really scared. And I remember I said to her as I sat by her bedside, I said, you know, let me show you where we can go. And I kind of did a little astral travel with her and took her over her house and took her over where her daughter was living in school. And just, you know, kept showing her all the great places that she could go. And I knew she was really afraid that she wasn't going to have anybody on the other side that she knew. And I could sense and hear, really, you know, speak to her higher self in the silence, and know that she was really scared that she wasn't going to have anybody that she was going to know on the other side. So I slept over next to her bed. And the next morning I woke up, and I was really early in the morning, and I knelt by her side, and I just called in every one of the guides that I had ever met along my healing journey, and asked them to introduce themselves to my friend. Even though she had her own guides, even though she had her own angel, I just, I remember doing that and seeing the guides and the angels line up to meet my friend. And it was a really beautiful experience. Meanwhile, she's in the hospital. She's not speaking. She's nearly dying physically. And she was holding on, and she was holding on because she was so scared. And so the night that she died, I was really tired, and I had left to go get something to eat. And I had gotten word that she was really anxious, and she was seemed really anxious and in pain. So I immediately rushed back to the hospital to be with her. And I could tell that she was getting ready to cross over. And she was just, her heart, you know, she was like kind of shaking, like as if she was having an anxiety moment. And I just said, okay, come on, let's go. And I put my hand over her heart just to kind of calm her down. And I said, let's go. And then I saw, when I took her hand and went to the space energetically where she was, that she was standing in front of a dark tunnel. And that was the first time I had seen the dark tunnel. And in retrospect, I remember I would kept telling her what it's like to cross over, and you see this light and it's there ain't and all this wonderful stuff. Well, I kept telling her about my amazing experience that I had the second time. And I'm having this shared death experience with her, and she's standing in front of a dark tunnel. And I immediately understood why she was so scared, because as her spirit was leaving her physical body and entering the other realm, she was seeing a dark tunnel, and I wasn't aware that she was seeing a dark tunnel. And but in that moment, when I was with her spirit, and she, it was time for her to go, it was time for her to go. She could not hold on any longer. She stood in front of the dark tunnel, and I remember, you know, saying, you know, I've got your hand. I'll walk through this with you. I'll go through it. And, you know, she starts to run, and then she turned around and ran back out of the tunnel. And then she ran down the tunnel, and then she turned around and ran back out of the tunnel. And I said to her, her name was Cammy. I said, Cammy, you've got to keep going. You got to keep going. Just keep going. There's light at the end of the tunnel. And she that time she just ran, and I was with her. I stood with her the whole time, and she ran, and I just remember I kept screaming, keep running, keep going, keep going, keep going. Don't stop, don't stop, don't stop. And then there was like an explosion of light, and she was there. And I remember saying, you're here, you're here. And, oh God, it was so powerful. And then I saw the line of guides that she had seen in the hospital bed early. And they all lined up and they all gave her, they were just welcoming her with a gift of something. They were handing her something. And she saw the angels. And then I remember the last thing I said to her was, there he is. And then I saw the master healer and she was walking towards him. And it was the most incredible experience. I mean, my near death, my second near death was really profound for me, but sharing that death with her and bringing her over was probably the most incredible experiences I've ever had in my life. And again, you know, coming back, Simon, it was like after my near death, who the heck is going to believe me that I had just taken my friend to the other side?
In this next clip, we hear from Christian Sundberg, who talks about a remarkable out-of-body experience he had.
Could you tell us about the time, I think you said your body was asleep and you came across the soul of your wife's ex-boyfriend?
Yes. Yes, this is not a body experience, a non-physical experience where, so up until this experience, I had not been a fan of my wife's ex-boyfriend, just because at the time I was kind of early in my awakening process and I still had this pretty silly ego associations with him and with it. But I had this beautiful experience where I saw his nature at, this is just so beyond words. I saw and felt and knew his nature as like an ocean of color and vibration, like a universe of color. And I could feel how his nature overlapped with my wife's nature and how there was this really holy, actually, overlap with how their souls both tend to pursue creativity, actually. There's this beautiful overlap in that they're both masterfully creative in a certain way, and they really helped each other in exploring that with each other. And simultaneously, I felt how his nature and my nature, his soul and my soul overlapped. And it was breathtakingly beautiful. I felt that he and I shared what I can only describe as an ancient honor. Like we both have this like deep, deep love for honor and an honoring and like being honorable and living in a way where honor is a strength. And I felt how he was living this human life and how he had received almost no love at all in this life. It was like if you took Play-Doh and squished it under a car tire so that it was like so thin you couldn't even measure it. That was how he felt in this life because of the complete absence of the giving of love to him that he had experienced. Like he had experienced such a lack of love and he was trying to create from that place. And that was like one of his main soul intentions was to create from this place of being so constrained. Like it sounds kind of like, you know, from a human, it's like, why would we do that? But he was such a master in certain ways that this was like a new level of expression and mastery and evolution for him. And so after I had this experience, I called him on the phone the next day and I was like, man, I think I saw your soul last night. Well, I know how this sounds, but let me just tell you. So I just shared with him for like, you know, 40 minutes or something, everything that I felt. And when I was done, he said, you know, if I had to describe who I really am, it would sound pretty close to that. And now to this day, he's actually really close to our family. He's a close family friend and he hangs out with us. And every time I see this guy, I mean, he, on the visual surface, he may appear pretty gruff. He's not the kind of person that like most people would just walk up to and be, friendly with. He doesn't look inviting to the average person. But I feel like kneeling to this guy every time I see him. I just want to love him and support him. And I'm like, man, you are doing something awesome here. And I applaud it. And so that sounds like a really interesting, it certainly was a very life-touching experience, but I just want to point out that that's not unique. Like, what I mean is we all are on journeys that are so incredibly precious in some way. And when it's seen from the other side, like when you have true sight of who we really are and what we're really doing, there is so much respect and love for it, for who we are and for what we're doing. Like, it's just like, we are like, I think it was Amy Call. She's a near-death experiencer. I remember in her NDE, she said we were seen as like superheroes on the other side for being willing to come and do this. And, you know, I really relate to that. You know, that feeling that there's just so much respect when we can see, when not only we can see each other, but when, you know, the other side, when beings who are not physical can look at us and see us. There's so much respect for what we're doing, what we're accomplishing, and the rigors, the human earthly rigors that we're dealing with every day are so intense that, wow, there's just so much understanding and respect. You know, I think so many people are so afraid, this is kind of a tangent, but I just feel it's important to say, so many people are so afraid of, you know, doing a terrible job of being judged. You know, there's such a belief in separation from God and sin and hell even. But man, the love and the wisdom and the understanding from the other side is so complete and so personal. Like, we are each known more than we know ourselves. And the degree to which we are loved is beyond what we can even fathom. So I know that was a bit of a tangent, but I feel like that's meaningful to say.
Hello, this is me, Simon. Did you know that during a past life regression, you can meet with your spirit guide? I conduct past life regression sessions over Zoom, and I've guided many clients to a spiritual encounter with their guide. If you would like to ask me how a session would work for you, you can book a free 20-minute consultation on my website, pastliveshypnosis.co.uk. The link is in the show notes. Next, Mike Anthony describes a spiritual event at a Penn and Teller performance.
There was an amazing thing that happened when you're in the theatre, you're watching Penn and Teller. It was almost like a kick in the teeth for Penn while he was talking.
Yes, this was really something. As I said, they do a show called... they do a bit called the Psychic Magician, I think is the name of the bit. Now, so as it turned out, I was in the middle of making this documentary, right? I had started making this documentary. I'm watching Angelina day after day do these amazing things with people I know she knows nothing about. And I've really now started to believe, oh my gosh, my dad really did communicate. That really was him telling her to mention my hair. This is real. And in the middle of that, as I said, I work for a theater company on Broadway, and we have 8 different theaters that I work for. And in one of our theaters, during the time that I was making the film, Penn and Teller came to do one of their magic shows. They were spending about a month doing a show at our theater. And I picked up the playbill and found out that they were doing that bit, the psychic magician bit, where they, quote unquote, debunk mediumship. And I thought, oh my gosh, what a fantastic coincidence. I'm making this documentary, and I had been very interested in Penn and Teller. They have a show on Showtime, or had, called Bullshit. That's the name of the show. And they use it to, quote unquote, again, debunk anything paranormal, and they focus very heavily on mediums. So I'd been interested in interviewing Penn. To ask him what it is that I'm missing. You know, I wanted Penn to come and sit with me as I'm watching Angelina do these things. And you tell me, what am I missing? How is she doing this? And so then, oh my gosh, she's going to be at our theater. What a fantastic turn of events. So I go in on the first night to watch, and they begin this bit, and he begins it with this rant against mediums. He calls them pigs. He uses all sorts of terrible names. Because again, he believes there is no such thing as anything paranormal. So he begins this part of the show by saying what we're going to show you right now is all fake and we're only showing it to you so that you will know anyone claiming this is just doing what I'm doing right now. It's all fake. Anyone who claims to know anything about anything, anyone who claims to be a paranormal, whatever, it's bullshit is what he says. And he pauses between the two words to really emphasize it. So then he and Teller go on to do this, this trick where they, appear to be reading people's minds. And I won't go into all of the details of it. Suffice to say, it's amazing. And you leave there thinking, how in the world did they do that? And I was standing at the back of the theater, totally crestfallen. I really was, because I'm thinking, well, if they can do this, this is just a trick, maybe Angelina somehow is doing some version of what they're doing right now. I can't see how it's possible. You know, again, Penn and Teller have spent their lives perfecting these things. Angelina has had a whole, you know, mediumship was not her whole life. She had a whole other life. You know, I don't know where she would have found the time to learn all of these tricks. Beside the point, I was in the back of the theater, crushed, thinking maybe I was somehow being fooled. So I decided I was going to go back the next night to watch it again, to see if on the second viewing I could figure out some of what they were doing. And I'm standing in the back of the theater again, and he begins the same spiel, and it's word for word. It's the same script as the night before, where he talks about how evil people are who claim to do this. And he says again, the very same words, everything you're about to see is bull. And then he pauses. And Simon, as I'm standing there crushed, putting myself through this again, I see, after he says bull, a flutter up in the lights about 10 feet above Penn's head. And sure enough, it's a freaking butterfly. It's this big butterfly above Penn's head in the Marquee Theater on Broadway. Now, this butterfly, Penn doesn't know any of this is happening, right? He's standing there giving this speech. Everything you're about to see is bullshit. While over his head, this butterfly is fluttering around, and it's so big, it starts going like over, you know, the audience area. And there's a titter in the audience. You know, people are saying, oh wow. Cause it's an extremely rare thing, Simon, to see a butterfly in a Broadway theater, extremely rare. I've now worked on Broadway for 17 years. This was the first time I had ever seen a butterfly in a Broadway theater ever. And by that point, butterflies had already come to have such significance for me, right? Because I'd had these butterfly experiences. So in this moment, this is one of those moments that you will never be able to take away from me, that Michael Shermer or Penn Jillette or any other skeptic will never be able to take away from me. As Penn is saying, this is all bullshit. My dad seemed to me to be right over Penn's head with the butterfly telling me, oh no, it's not. Oh no, it's not. And if only Penn knew that moment where he's explicating why this is all fake, that my dad was using it for the opposite purpose. Oh my gosh. And I should also say, you know, the Marquee Theater, it's inside the Marquee Hotel in Times Square. So to get into the theater, you have to go in on the ground floor, right, through revolving doors. You have to go up an escalator to the third floor. Then you have to go in through the theater doors to get into the theater. And then you have to go in through another set of doors to get into the actual house where the actual, you know, theater is. And I don't know if you've been to Times Square before, Simon, but it's not exactly a sanctuary for butterflies anyway, even outside. You know, I don't know how many times I could count, you know, I'm sure I could count on one hand the number of times I've seen a butterfly in Times Square ever. I mean, there's just not a whole lot of greenery for them to be to be around. So seeing one in Times Square alone is interesting. Seeing one inside the Marquee Theater up there on the third floor at the moment that Penn is saying mediumship is fake seemed to me to be significant. A few days after that, I was back in my theater, the Richard Rogers Theater, and I was talking with my coworker, Marie about this. You know, she had followed my story, obviously. She knew about my dad and everything. And I was talking about seeing this butterfly over Penn's head. And I'm saying to her, you know, have you ever seen a butterfly in a Broadway theater? I mean, come on. Have you ever seen that? And she says, no. We're behind the bar having this conversation, facing each other. And as we're having the conversation, out of the corner of my eye, again, I see a flutter and I look over, and sure enough, there's now a butterfly in front of us in our theater. And it lands up in the chandelier in the Richard Rogers lobby. And I have pictures in the book of the butterfly and also people looking at it. And you can see the sort of shocked expression on their faces, and they don't even know about my story. Their look of surprise is simply because there's a butterfly inside the theater. They don't even know the greater context that I am living in that moment. So there you go. You know, you can obviously do with the story what you please. For me, it all certainly seemed significant. And then I'll also say, you know, a couple of days after the butterfly was in the Rogers, Penn, who had a night off from his show, happened to be standing under that chandelier. He came to see Hamilton on Broadway. And he was standing right, his elbow was on my bar. And I had been waiting for so long because I had talked to him. He'd agreed to be in the documentary. That this was before I saw the butterfly over his head, right? This was before all of that. So then he's standing there with his elbow on my bar. And this would have been the perfect time to get him to be in the to talk to him more about it. And by that point, I no longer needed it. I just didn't need it anymore. And so I said nothing. I realized that there are people that you simply cannot convince. There are some people that no amount of evidence is ever going to be enough for them. And that's fine. That is fine. I no longer need the validation from those people, which is a great place to be. and that's where I'm at now. The reason I wrote this book is because there are people grieving and suffering out there. And from my perspective, there is information available that might make that grieving more bearable. And I wrote the book so that the information is out there if you want it. If you want it, it's out there. If you don't want it, fine. That is 100% fine with me. I'm done trying to convince people who don't want to be convinced. But if there are people who are looking for hope and comfort, based on what I consider to be rigorous evidence, rigorously gained evidence, that information is available for people who want it / need it.
Now we hear from Professor Jay Cozzolino, who is studying children's past life memories at the Division of Perceptual Studies at the University of Virginia School of Medicine. Do you see a common pattern in children related to their past lives that might indicate why they remember their past lives?
That's a really good question. I will tell you that we don't quite know the answer. We have some hypotheses, which is what we're trying to do. The grant I mentioned earlier that Marietta Pilavinova and I received, these €500,000, the sort of motivating question at the top of our proposal that we submitted to the agencies that gave us the money, the question is, why these children? What is it about these children that is leading to these experiences, these purported memories? What is it unique? Is there something unique about them, inherently them, but also potentially about the memories that they're discussing? It's difficult. We have a dual pathway hypothesis. It's a little bit wonky. But our best guess at this point that we're testing, that's what this study is, right? Whereas this grant, why I said earlier, it's sort of a novel approach, and not just getting the money was kind of unheard of, but also it's everything historically has basically been case studies. So a case comes up in India or in America or, you know, wherever, and I go and we investigate, and then we investigate again, and then we figure out something, we get new information, and then we chase that down, right? That's what these researchers are doing. And then they report the study of James Leininger or Ryan Hammonds or any of the people that we, and then we, of course, have aggregated them into this big database that we have, but they were all just individual case studies. This isn't that. This is going to be the first attempt to try to bring children into, in a sense, the lab. Sometimes we have to bring the lab equipment to them to test them in the context of trauma and emotion, which is one of the pathways. We talked about it earlier, the birthmarks, the xenoglossy. There seems to be something about that that is... So the best way I can describe that, just to make it clearer in a data sense, is in our database of roughly 2,300 cases, 63% of them have talked about how they died. But of that 63%, 75% have described a traumatic, unnatural death. So clearly, there's something about trauma here that is linked to why these kids are remembering. Now, what's interesting is it doesn't seem that they've experienced trauma in this life. So again, I'm not sure why it may be. Again, if we're going to speculate that this is something connected to a past life, maybe that traumatic process, the unexpectedness, right? Maybe there's something about how that consciousness needed to continue moving on this plane and just said, I got to go. And somehow, again, pure speculation, just for the fun of it. I have no idea. I'm just trying to make sense of this in the context of if it is something like a reincarnation process. The trauma thing is there. It's not a biased part of the database, I don't believe. It really isn't. We have data that suggests the unexpected nature, verified unexpected nature of the previous person's death predicts shorter intermission periods, right? So, which is not something a child could fake. It's not something that, like, a child is born and then they start telling a story and then verified later, we find a case that matches what they're saying and we figure out and we can verify that in fact, that death was an unexpected, often traumatic death. And those cases are significantly faster to have reincarnated, if you want to use that term, than cases that didn't have unexpected traumatic deaths. There's something that's not, a child couldn't, it's just two things occurred in space and time, and there is a systematic relationship. There's something there, maybe. I don't know, but it's worth pursuing. The other pathway is we just think these kids might, we have good links to what we mentioned earlier, that we know they're more intelligent for their age. We know they're more verbal for their age. Both of those things probably we know in the literature should predict that they just have better memories. So they just make their, in this incarnation, in this life, they just may have better memory processes. And we think we know already they likely do. We're going to test it a little bit more robustly. That's been tested in the past. And that's autobiographical memory, not just like, so of their own existence, of their own life right now. And we're going to be bringing kids into the lab, control kids, past life memory kids. And we're going to test that and say, are these children actually, do they have better memory processes than others? And one of the things I'm interested in is when you go down that road of studying memory in children, there's a great researcher, her last name is Bauer. She's done a lot of work on memory in children, not in past life memories, just memory in children. And she talks about in one or a couple of her papers, something that's really fascinating to me in this context of these past life memories is she speaks about memory. We often think of it as, she says, in this positive way, meaning not positive, negative, meaning good or bad, but just meaning like, oh, information came in, I encoded it, and now I've retrieved it. That's what we think of as memory, right? Like, oh, I can pull it out. There it is. I have this memory. But there's another part of it that she kind of refers to more as like a negative process. Again, not bad, just which is the forgetting process. It is its own unique thing, how we come to forget and how easy it is to forget things. And there are specific ways that you can test that and explore that in the lab. And I think that could be a part of this too. It may be that the kids do have better memory, sort of positive memory, maybe better to encode and retrieve. But it may also be that these PLM kids, these past life memory kids, are that their forgetting processes are not as active and are, in a sense, thwarted compared to other kids. And because they clearly, if again, you want to speculate that this is a memory from a past life, they're not forgetting it. Right. So maybe this a combination of whatever happened to this consciousness before, whoever this biological being is now. Again, it's speculative. I wish I had a better answer for you. But like most researchers answering questions about just about anything, it's an ongoing process.
In this next clip,
Linda Kramer talks about an amazing photo she took while she was on a ghost tour.
Really interesting photos in your book. Can you tell us how they came about?
I went on a ghost tour, and it was the Toowong Cemetery here in Brisbane. It's a really big cemetery. So there was about three of us. Actually, I was with a man called Fraser, who is in the book, and there was about four of us, but Fraser was very scared that night, and he knows what I do. So he said, Linda, can I please stay with you? And I said, of course you can, darling. You know, I'll put up my protections and we'll be fine. So it's a very dark cemetery. I'd say 80% of the tombstones go back to the late 1700s, early 1800s. You know, so there's no paths. It's all just rockery, falling down tombstones. It's very eerie. So we're there in the pitch dark with just our torches. And the tour guide said, we're about to go down to this area. Now, it's about 2 acres, which is about half a hectare of land. And she said, she gave us a story that when they made the new sports stadium, it was horrible what they did, Simon. They had to dig up a cemetery and relocate all the bodies. So instead of doing it humanely, they just got in bulldozers and just shoveled this cemetery into this other cemetery where we were about to go to. So the tour guide tells us this story that there's about 250,000 bodies that have just been dumped in this one area over this 2-acre plot of land. And she said they call it Death Valley. And then as she's telling us the scary story, she said, who would like to go down there first? Obviously, I put my hand up. Fraser's looking at me like, oh, no way. I am not going down there. So I said, Fraser, I'll go alone if you don't want to go down first, because it was pitch black. So I had my phone out. And every time I took photos, my flash would work. But when I was standing at Death Valley, I took a photo to the right, a photo to the straight in front of me, and then a photo to my left, trying to just get it like a panoramic view of this huge vacant allotment where they'd buried all these people. And my flash didn't work, which I didn't really, didn't really click. So then other people come down and we're walking around to further tombstones, talking about this man's buried there, this is this person, famous person. And we got to this politician and I wasn't interested in learning who this politician was that was buried there. So I thought, I'll just go back through my photo stream on my phone, my camera, and just see what I've got. Those three photos have been lightened, but they are not touched up in any way or form. So I have sent them over to a paranormal group in America, and they have established that there is no photoshopping, there is no editing on there. They've only been lightened because my flash didn't work. And the interesting thing about those photos, there's white noise all around his head, including at his neck where his body should be. So he was only standing about 2 feet in front of my camera, because that photo is exactly off my camera's stream. So he would have only been about 2 feet in front of my camera, but there's no body. He's looking straight into the camera. He wanted his photo taken. So I did ring the cemetery and I said, look, I've looked at his glasses that he's wearing. And I said, oh, look, I don't know his age. He could be 30, he could be 45. He's wearing glasses. So, I've been Googling like types of different frames from the 1930s, 1950s, 1970s. So he's probably from about 1940 onwards. So, I told the cemetery, we're looking for a male between 35 and we'll say 30, 45, male, who died probably 1940s onwards. And guess what she said? Could be one of about 3,000 people that she knows of that's actually buried. And then she said, do you remember there is that block of land where there is at least 250 people that are unmarked graves? So he didn't talk to me at all. He didn't even let me know he was there. I didn't see him at all. But, you know, I've got a photo of the group because we were in a tour. So they took a photo of everybody at the end. He's not on the tour. He doesn't even look remotely like anyone else. The only person I would say that he sort of looks like is Fraser. But it wasn't Fraser because Fraser doesn't wear glasses. So, and Fraser's got long hair. You would have seen it. You know, it would have been a different style. So Fraser's in my book because I do go through, you know, when they first start to manifest, it takes a lot of energy. So the first thing that we see is a mist or an orb. So, you know, I was walking ahead of Fraser and he said, my God, Linda, I feel someone's here. So I've instantly just turned around, took that photo. And there's Fraser with this like really weird expression on his face. And he's got this big orb next to his head because he could sense that it was there. So the first way they come through are orbs. Then they can come in as a mist, which is like when we exhale cigarette smoke. They come through like a mist. They can also manifest in that part. So you might see a hand. You might see part of their head. You may see part of their foot or some clothing. But then you've got your full-bodied apparitions like Shelley. And that takes immense energy to come through in that formation. So I hope that I've explained that in the book. How they manifest. You know, it takes a lot of energy because they're not in our dimension. They're in a totally different dimension. They have to come through into this dimensional plane of this 3D existence that we live in. What's their intention of doing it? There is always an intention. They don't generally just do it for a game. Oh, let's just go into this portal today. No, you know, they don't do that. So, you know, that's why they appear when they're around us. Yep, keep going.
That was a number of clips I've put together from the Patreon extended episodes. And you can become a patron by going to patreon.com/ourparanormalafterlife. Or click on the Patreon button on my homepage at pastliveshypnosis.co.uk. The links are in the show notes. And my book on verified near-death experiences is on Amazon, and you can get it on paperback, audiobook, or Kindle. And if you enjoy the podcast, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening.